for Tuesday, February 6th, 2007. We're going to begin today with our public hearing on House Bill 2239, and we'll open the public hearing on that bill. Mr. Phillips, and we'll hear a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2239 will modify procedure for reviewing assessment rules. It corrects clerical errors and omissions, and basically one of the things it does is it clarifies for the taxpayer which dates exactly he needs to reflect upon when he applies for a request and to appeal to the department for some kind of a conference regarding the assessment of his property. And under current law, it says something like the 20th day after or prior to second Monday in June prior to July 1. These minor changes were the intent of the bill. However, there is a clause in the current bill that wasn't, I believe, unintended. It would rescind the department's ability to correct an error in valuation judgment, and I believe an amendment is coming in that regard.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for hearing 2239 today. This deals with a section of law that's rarely people are rarely aware of and affects a small number of people, but it's very important for those that deal with it, and so I'm happy to bring this to you today. I'd like to talk, first of all, I'd like to let you know that last year, in the late part of the previous year, we met with stakeholders that are affected by this bill and this section of law. We had a series of meetings to talk about what in this law could be addressed in terms of updating and streamlining and those kinds of things. And we came up with a number of ideas, and those ideas are contained in this bill. What I'd like to do, though, is to give you a little bit of context for it first and talk conceptually about what's in the bill, talk a little bit about what central assessment means, and then go through and section by section, as long as you can tolerate it, talk to you about what actually the bill mechanically does. So you should have a handout, and the first part is dealing with sort of a summary. And there are a lot of provisions in this section of law that are, pretty archaic. The laws were originally written right around 1909. This is when the state of Oregon started being responsible for assessing large types of companies that are like electric companies, gas companies, communication companies, transportation companies. So what I mean by confusing is that there's some archaic terminology. Some of the process is a little bit out of sequence, where actually it goes to A, and then it goes to C, and then it goes to B, so the steps are a little bit out. And then there's some incomplete thoughts that I'd like to talk about. The law actually works, and people that work with it understand it, but it could be very confusing if you ever pick it up and work with it, and these would help to clean it up. We've been talking about doing this for years, and now we're bringing it to you. So just some definitions. Central assessment means that for these certain numbers of companies, which I'll detail later, the Department of Revenue appraises them. Every year, we determine the value for them, certify that value to the county assessor, and then the taxes are calculated on that property. Roll means the record that we prepare with all of those values. We prepare a record, counties prepare a record, and we share and certify that record to the counties. Tentative means that it's a draft. It's a roll that we prepare in draft form, and then we're going to talk to taxpayers about it and say, what do you think about this? Do we have it right? We have a period of conversation, and then we certify a final rule. So how does it modernize references? Well, there are a lot of references to things like setting forth that it will attend, sitting for the purposes of reviewing, a lot of phrases that are archaic and have been around for decades, if not close to a century. So it addresses those. How does it clarify timelines? What it tries to do is simply put A, B, C, D as things occur. That's how it should appear in statute. It also obscures some time frames and notices to taxpayers. For example, it provides for notices to be sent 20 days before the second Monday in June. And we've talked with taxpayers about maybe just what date works for you, and let's just set a date. And the current law mixes some ideas about when a role is corrected. Are we correcting the current role we're working on developing, the draft, or are we correcting a tax record from some previous year? Because there are different things you can do with those records. And how does it clearly restate the law relative to the appeal process? It clarifies, it's going to attempt to clarify that the first discussion is with the director of the department with that tentative role saying, you know, can you help us? What do we need to get right here? What's wrong? What did we misunderstand? And then we have a conversation, and then from that discussion, then there's an appeal to the tax court magistrate division. So it clearly lays that out. Page 3 in your handout is the primer, and I feel a little responsible to give you some context, because you probably don't talk about this on a daily basis with your friends and probably have never been subject to an appraisal by the Department of Revenue for this kind of property. Probably don't own an electric company, for example. So I'm just going to give you a real brief context for it. Locally assessed property, that's the property like residential, commercial, small industrial. Your county assessor goes out and appraises those property and creates a roll or a record. For large industrials and centrally assessed, what we call centrally assessed, the Department of Revenue does that. So we work with the taxpayers and try to determine the values and set that roll. These particular properties that I'm referring to as centrally assessed are typically ones that cross county lines, cross state lines, and involve a large network of property, whether it be wire miles, rail miles, or a network that's very comprehensive and complex. So who is subject to central assessment? I'm kind of at the bottom of page 3. These are utilities like electric and gas, transportation, such as air, rail, and water, and communications. And I just included in your handout the statute that lists all the companies and the businesses' services that are required to be appraised by the department. On page 4, the property that's subject to central assessment. So now we know the companies. What's the property? And it's pretty broad and almost all-inclusive in that it's real, personal, tangible, and intangible. It's the entire unit of the company. The third thing is that I wanted to point out was what are the taxpayers' responsibilities. And this is simply to report annually their assets and their company's status. And there's more to it than that, but that's the general concept. What's your property, and what are the values on that property? The fourth point deals for a fundamental understanding of this process is kind of the step-by-step. What happens? Just so that you know, in the calendar year, the taxpayer sends in statements that say, this is our value, this is our property. The appraisers then in our department and division then evaluate that and make changes from last year, apply depreciation schedules, and do all of the analysis that they do. Then a notice is mailed to the taxpayer saying, okay, we're going to start reviewing the roll. Here are our values for your property. They're given a chance to request a conference with the director, and then the director in mid-June begins holding conferences and reviewing the roll. The director of the department has to finalize that by August 1st to get it to the counties so that they can calculate the taxes and get the tax statements mailed on time. During the conference, the director can make changes to that tentative or draft roll. It can be clerical error or mistakes on property reported, changes in value, depending on the discussions or what we find out from the taxpayer. Throughout the year, though, the director can make changes to other rolls, the rolls records from the past, like last year's record or the year before's record. If a mistake was made, if property was not included that should have been. And these are kind of parallel concepts to what the assessor can do for residential and commercial. The problem is here is that a lot of the language has not been changed over the years, but on the assessor's roll correction language, there's been constant updates and changes as we found little mistakes. And what we're trying to do is bring these two correction provisions for what the assessor does and what the department does sort of in parallel together. So following the certification of the roll, the director completes her work, certifies the roll to the counties, and then the taxpayer can appeal that value, that final value, to the tax court. So that's an overview of sort of the perimeter of centrally assessed property. And If it's your desire, I'll move on to the section-by-section review of the bill.
Are there questions so far?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Just before we go section for section, John, this fourth part that you just covered, the process and the timelines, you're not substantially changing that process, just clarifying, or does this bill also change that process in any substantive way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the attempt is not to change the process at all. The idea and the concept is just to simply put it in a chronological order in the statute.
Great.
Okay.
Other questions? I think we're ready for your section by section.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Section one, one of the issues that came up in our meetings that we had with stakeholders and that our staff have surfaced was this whole date of the second Monday in June and the 20 days before the second Monday in June. So section one simply amends 305.580 to say we're going to put June 15th as that date rather than the second Monday in June. So it's their legislative council has made some other changes for clarity, like the fact that in line 8 it says that, you know, the department will it will attend to its office in the Capitol. You know, it's some archaic language. And that's pretty much the sum and substance of Section 1.
Historically interesting. Your office must have been in the Capitol then.
It may have been. I wasn't working for the department at that time.
No. And I don't believe anyone on the panel was here at that time either. Mr. Phelps, go ahead.
Okay. Section 2 outlines the process for notification to the taxpayer, advising them of the contents of the tentative rule. This is the draft saying, here's your notice, these are the values, and this is the property we show for you. And this appears as new language. However, you'll see in Section 6 that it's been taken out of an existing statute and separated out and placed earlier in the process when it actually happens. It happens in Section 6 sub 2. So, again, this changes the date to May 25th from the existing language, which is 20 days prior to the second Monday in June. And also, let's see, I think that I mentioned that Section 6 sub 2 is where this was previously located. Section 3 establishes the taxpayer and or the company's right to request a conference. And so it can review and comment. This section clarifies the process for the resolution of the values and emphasizing the importance of resolving these errors before the roll is certified final. One of the problems that if we don't deal with it at this point, then we certify the final roll, the assessor calculates tax, sends out the tax statements, collects the tax, and then maybe there's a refund, a legitimate refund coming to that taxpayer because of mistakes. So the whole idea is to have a conversation. We're dealing with a lot of value, a lot of property. When you think about companies like PGE or Northwest Natural Gas or, you know, other companies, Verizon, there's a lot of property.
Mr. Chair.
So,
Representative Butler.
Thank you, John. Those are all very large companies, as you say. Are there any of those folks that are presently in contest with the department over the resolution of values and property issues for any of their property and values?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't have personal knowledge of that, but I think there's almost always an appeal occurring. I can tell you specifically, however, that at the bottom of page 4, for the 05-06 tax year, we have 400 companies. We had 95 requests for conference to the director.
So just about 25% of them.
Uh-huh. And 4 of those were appealed beyond the director to review. So what we typically find, Representative Butler, is in committee, is that a lot of companies will just put in a protective request for a conference. They may never even come to the conference, but you know, it's in their best interest to put in a request for a conference, and then if the appraiser and the company can work it out, then the conference never occurs. So we do get a lot of requests for conference, but we get very few actual appeals resulting.
So then with regard to subsection 3 and item 4 under subsection 3, conference, then is the remedy that you would seek. Do you anticipate that more of those 400 companies than the existing approximately 100 would be seeking a conference with the director as a result of the clarification of this language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't think it changes the process other than it changes the date on which it occurs, changes it to, I believe Section 3 changes it to, I don't think there's the change. There's not a change.
I see it coming out of Section 6 with the conference and notice and
yes.
so forth. It's being pulled out of there and then moved forward in Section 3.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make
same provisions. It's just okay. a timing
Good.
Issue.
For the most part, we just simply moved the sections around and specified the dates.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's satisfactory. Thank you. That's responsive.
And in Section 4, this section addresses the department's preparation of the next assessment role. It eliminates some archaic references to at the Capitol again, second Monday in June, those kinds of things. I hesitate to call it a housekeeping bill because there are some moving around, but it, you know, in essence, it's a housekeeping bill. In Section 5...
You might alert us when you come across things that are intended to change the actual procedure.
I will. Thank you.
If we're only talking about a date, then, of course, you point that out.
Right.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 5 edits the statute to separate out actions. And this is the part where I was talking about. There's this tentative draft role, and then there's these other roles. And you can find a clerical error, a mistake, something spelled wrong or something's inadvertently done. That doesn't affect the value. You can find that on any role. And so the way the law currently is constructed, it talks about the director preparing the tentative role. And then it goes through the steps of saying, well, the director can correct clerical errors and the director can add omitted property. Well, omitted property is not really a tentative role concept. It's something from a previous role. So that statute sort of mixes two concepts. And so what we did in the bill is we separated the director's review of the draft role from the director's changes allowed made for all other certified roles.
Question there.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, these when there are in fact errors and these go to conference and then are eventually settled, of the companies that are centrally assessed, when I look at the utilities, energy utilities, being electric and gas, don't all of those folks that would have appeals, no matter how those are settled, if they're settled for more money, don't most all of those just pass those through to ratepayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, we deal with the appraisal of property and tax, you know, assessors, you know, and the collectors. But in terms of what...
If I could just clarify what my question is. So my question is this. You mentioned PGE, I think, just a moment ago, having some conference. If PGE had a question about an assessment issue, which was centrally assessed, and their challenge was over the value of a property, which increased their tax by $1 million, wouldn't the $1 million just go back into the rates that everyone else is paying, that all taxpayers pay, basically in the utility rates?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I thought we were talking about changes to the role for clerical errors and errors.
Right, but to add property in for a clerical error.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the errors that we're talking about here don't necessarily add value. They're clerical in nature. They're not. In fact, there's a provision in the bill that says that the director can the department cannot make a change in valuation judgment on these kinds of errors. It specifically tries to parallel what's in another statute that deals with residential commercial for assessors that they use. The idea is that if you're making changes under a clerical error, that you don't impose a valuation judgment. And you come up with another, in other words, you don't try to come up with another opinion of what the value of that property is. You simply correct an error.
So, Mr. Chair, this is strictly correcting clerical errors. It would not correct or change values or tax rates at any point under 305 to 308.
If I might.
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. In Section 5, this is the one we're trying to focus just on the tentative rule. What we're seeing here is the Department of Revenue shall review, examine, and correct the tentative rule prepared under the statute. B, increase or reduce the valuation of property assessed so that the valuation is the assessed value of the property. This is during the tentative rule. And we're taking out assess omitted property because that's not a concept of a tentative rule.
I see.
C, correct errors in apportionment. This is where you've got a large company, it's got property in, let's say, 30 counties, and you've apportioned 5% to Baker County and 35% to Multnomah, and you've made a mistake in the apportionment. So you're not increasing the value nor the tax of the company. You're just apportioning the value differently. D, correct errors in the ratio of average maximum assessed value to market value. That's a measure 50 concept, and if there's I don't know of any errors that occur in that area since there's only one ratio and it's always the same, so not familiar with where that came from. Two, if it appears the director of any real property has been that is permitted to assess, that has been assessed more than one time. So if you find property that's been assessed twice, you can correct it. In that case, it's not going to increase the value of the property nor create an additional tax obligation. Subsection 3, which is on line 5 and page 3, this is for property discovered by the director that's not assessable. That should be corrected. 4, which is on line 8, same page. If it appears the director that any real personal property assessable has not been assessed, the director shall assess the property that's valued. So if during that tentative rule the director discovers property, either the taxpayer tells the director or they otherwise do a site visit and find something that isn't on the roll, they can add it.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point is that if they're adding at that point, doesn't it change the tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that the point of Section 5 is that they're trying to decide what is property and what is its value. So at this point, there's been no tax levied.
Okay.
And the other changes in that section are simply clerical corrections by LC, I think.
Yes.
Okay, Section 6.
Section 6 describes the additional notice requirements for two taxpayers that the department must make.
And unless I misunderstand, there's some minor changes in language, and subsection 2 and subsection 3 were moved to section 3.
Yes.
That we've already discussed, and
yes.
Otherwise there are no changes.
Right. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Are there questions about Section 6? Go on to Section 7, please.
Section 7 is the new language for changes that are made to roles, historical roles, past roles. So they're not limited to this mid-June to August 1 date. This can happen any time during the year that a mistake is discovered. These kinds of errors are listed, and starting on the top of page 4, it describes what a clerical error is. And this is almost identical language to what's in law in ORS 311-205, which talks about clerical errors that an assessor might discover. Again, we're trying to parallel what the assessor does with what the department does to the extent we can do that. The property is just a little bit different. So then in subsection 3, which is on line 7, page 4, the director may correct other kinds of errors besides clerical errors. And then it describes in A, B, C, D, and E those what those are. One of those is they may correct an error in value from an appeal. So if you have a roll from 3 years ago, there was an appeal, the court orders a new value, this allows the director to change the value on the record.
Okay. Does this section establish new authority in the department in order to give it similar kinds of authority and responsibility as the assessors, as the county assessors have on non-centrally assessed property? Or is it simply a restatement of a law that's somewhere else in this bill that you've removed?
Mr. Chair, it's an attempt to simply flesh out and restate what already exists. We found that in the confusion between the kinds of roles that are being corrected, mm-hmm. that we kept, like a couple of years ago, we added some provisions to flesh this out a little bit, but it was still in the wrong section. And, for example, there's some notice requirements to the taxpayer that we always performed. We always let them know, but it wasn't in the law. So we're adding that so that that's another assurity to the taxpayer that they'll get notice.
So part of this is for clarifying what you already do anyway,
mm-hmm.
and part of it is to make certain that the taxpayers understand what their rights are and what and how it is you're going to behave as you do your work.
Yes.
Thank you. All right. Section 8?
Section 8 is a new section created to detail that for any reason omitted property is added to historical roll. This particular section... So we talked about clerical errors in Section 7. Section 8 is the new section that just breaks out if property is discovered after the roll is final. And it's property that needs to be added. And if property is discovered that needs to be removed, that's covered in Section 7. If property is discovered that needs to be added because it either wasn't reported or for whatever reason, then it's added in Section 8. And again, this provides that the notice requirements and the appeal process if the taxpayer disagrees once they're noticed.
Okay, thank you.
Section 9 was added to spell out the due process notification for taxpayers when the director is contemplating adding the omitted property. So the sequence works like this. The property is discovered that wasn't on the tax rolls. The assessor sends a notice out saying, I'm contemplating adding this. Talk to me. The taxpayer either responds or does not respond. Then the director notifies the taxpayer again, we're adding this. It's another notice requirement.
And so this show cause language is to get a response. It could be a letter. It could be a request for an appointment.
Yes.
Any number of things.
Yes.
To let you know that the taxpayer wants to you to consider something else.
Yes. It's an invitation to resolve a question and clarify the issue. And then from that, they're notified that they can appeal if they disagree.
Sure. Representative Butler.
Thank you. John, I noticed that on line 8, that show cause, they only have the 20 days. Is that sufficient in your experience to come forward after a mailing of a notice has been received to come forward and be given the opportunity to appear before the department to show cause for these companies that may not have a residence right in Salem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm going to have to maybe ask for an opportunity to get back with you on that in part of the question, because I think that's a secondary step.
Okay.
I think there's a primary step at which the person is notified that invited to have the conversation, and then there's a second notice, and I think that what you're referring to in that line 8 is a second notice, but I'd like a chance to check on that, and I believe that is parallel, although I'll check it with the notice allowed to every other taxpayer that's been in the law in 311-216, but I can check that also.
Thank you.
If I'm permitted to do that, I appreciate it. And again, I think in the current law, there are no days listed at all, to my recollection. I'd have to read that section over again, though.
Hardly seems fair if we weren't given any time to respond to it.
Well, it probably means you have an infinite amount of time if there's nothing specified.
Okay.
So we're tightening that up a little.
Yes. And Mr. Chair, Section 10, and this is really getting close to the end here, even though it looks like we have 8 more sections.
I was going to suggest we shorten the end.
Yeah, we're going to move really quickly through that, because right. I know you're all capable of reading. This just talks about how then those final, you know, changes are made to the rules, the certified rules, and then notifying the assessor. That's new language, but I don't think that's ever been sort of spelled out in the law. We've just done it as a matter of course. It seems like the right thing to do is to let the assessor know that you've changed the role. And then it also gives another, in subsection 3 there, a person or company that's aggrieved an opportunity to appeal to the tax court once that role, that change has been made. And that's a 90-day opportunity. I think that, Representative Butler, is the 90 days I was looking for. And actually, that is, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the points where I've talked to Representative Barnhart about an amendment, because on line 23 it says, as prescribed, basically, 22 and 23, as prescribed in 305-275. And 305-275 is sort of the tax court statutes that say this is how an appeal is done and this is the procedure. But 305-280, the very next statute, is the one that gives the 90 days, and that was omitted. So that we've asked for an amendment to add 305-280 to that, so that there is a 90-day time frame and it's not open-ended.
And, Mr. Chair, is it your understanding that 90 days would run before the Section 9 20 days?
Now, Mr. Phillips, correct me, but if I understand it right, the 20 days in Section 9 refers to the time that the individual or the company has to ask to be heard at the department about the department's intention to add property to the rolls.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
And the 90-day appeal is the time that they have to appeal to tax court after the department has actually made the addition to the rolls.
That's exactly correct.
All right. Thank you. We might note, Mr. Phillips and committee, that we have a memo from dated January 18th, 2007, in which there are other suggested fixes, actually two suggested fixes, that one just mentioned being one of those, and the other one being in Section 7, where we went through the issue of the clerical correction to the rolls. And I understand that you are planning to, or you've asked for an amendment to be prepared so that we can make these corrections.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I have a handout that is identical to the one that I gave you on the 18th.
Oh, okay.
For the committee.
I thought the committee already had that. Do you? No?
No, we don't have it.
Okay. We'll make sure that you do. Thank you.
Certainly.
Yeah, we'll look at that. Now, the other issues, the other sections, are essentially corrections to terminology or the date in which this becomes effective and things of that sort. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So, Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment on that. Section 13, we're taking out language that says, sitting for the purpose of reviewing and apportioning the assessment rule shall continue sessions from day to day, exclusive of Sundays and legal holidays, till the examination, review, correction, equalization, apportionment of the rule is completed. That means that they're getting off on Saturday?
I guess so, Representative Butler. You think
hey, just wanted to make that on the record.
I see. We're not going to work them 6 days a week anymore.
I guess not.
Do you have a comment, Representative Mr. Phillips?
That's true, Ms. Representative Berger.
You know, if you look at these amendments, you see a little window into an earlier day and the way things were actually done. And, you know, I have this image of the director sitting at a desk waiting for all comers. Of course, it doesn't work that way now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
One last comment, and that is, and this is the one that I'm going to flag for you as being there may be a perception of a change here, and I'd be happy to talk at length. It's the one place in the bill that there may be a perception of a change. We don't think so. Our legal advice is that it's not a change, but you know, in fairness to everybody, that you're aware. And this is the part that deals with the appeal process. And I believe it's earlier in the bill. And it is in on page 2, section 3. And in Section 3, I'm particularly looking at subsections 3, 4, 5, and 6, which are essentially between lines 12 and 25. And in this section, it spells out in greater detail the process for disagreeing and resolving value and property. Historically, the director has held conferences. People file protective requests for conferences, or they show up. We discuss, we negotiate, resolve issues, and most of them are not appealed. In 4% of the cases, there's an appeal. And so we're clarifying that the request for conference is required, and you have to participate in a conference and work through these issues, or you've not completed or exhausted your administrative remedies. What we don't want to see, and what we haven't seen, because this is the way we've administered the law, is people jumping over that process and saying, we're not going to talk to the director, we're going to go to an appeal to the tax court. We don't see that. It hasn't been done, to my knowledge, and people understand that they need to have the conversation. That's why they file the protective appeal, or they have the conversation. So this spells it out in language that we think is crystal clear. Secondly,
are there any cases in point?
I'm not aware.
Has the tax court sent something back because that conversation didn't take place?
I'm not aware of any. I would have to ask people that have been working in this longer.
Okay. Thank you. Second place.
Subsection 5, which is on line 21, that's the part that refers to subject to subsection 4, no appeal to the tax court may be made under 305-280. In other words, this is the part that says, you can't appeal to the tax court unless you've had your... It's almost a restatement of saying you needed to exhaust your administrative remedy.
Right.
And Section 6 goes without saying, but it's been without saying, and we're offering that we actually spell it out in the statute and say there's no appeal to the Board of Property Tax Appeals. Refresh your memory on your orientation that Mary gave you. A Board of Property Tax Appeals is a local board. Mm-hmm. There's one, at least one in every county. They meet February to April or May. They hear appeals. It's sort of the first appeal for non-centrally assessed companies.
Right.
It's the discussion part for them. Centrally assessed companies don't get an appeal to the Board of Property Tax Appeals for a number of reasons. One, they get a conference with the director. Two, which county would they appeal to? I mean, would they go to the board in every county? I've got 25 miles of wire or pipe in your county, and I've got a substation in your county, and so... Practically speaking, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have a local board review a network system. And so this is the way we've operated. To my knowledge, we've had one appeal that was dropped over the years, none that have ever gone to the tax, the actual Board of Property Tax Appeals, and that were actually heard. And so we're just putting it in statute so that everybody's clear on what the policy is. So I'm drawing your attention to that because that explicitly has not been in the statute.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a question about this is an administrative remedy. Does the administrator ever waive having the meeting so that the folks can go directly to the Oregon Tax Court?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm not aware of that. I would have to actually inquire with the director and find out.
Thank you. While we're still here, have you seen the letter from the Intergovernmental Relations Office from the City of Eugene dated February 6th?
No, I have not.
Oh, all right. I'd like you to take a look at that letter. Paul, we have copies of that, do we? We can give him. Basically, the city is raising the question of notice to them in the event that there are changes in centrally assessed property. It would be useful to have your comment on both the effort, the possibility of doing that, and the difficulties that might be involved with it. The city is concerned about Hynix property, and because it's a large property, and there may be some other concerns too. So perhaps you might have a conversation with is it Mr. Kyler, their legislative analyst, and get back to us on that. Are there other questions for Mr. Phillips on this bill? I don't see any. Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to be heard today on House Bill 2239? We're obviously not finished with it. We have amendments to do and some conversations to have, at least with the City of Eugene. If not, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2239. I want to announce today now that we are not going to hold a work session on two of the three bills that we have before us today, and I'm going to unpack my papers a little bit so I can get to my list. We will not hold a work session on House Bill 2229 and House Bill 2236 because there are some issues that yet have to be addressed on those bills. And with that, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2234. Would you give us a summary?
Certainly, Chair Van Hoen. House Bill 2234, as we discussed on the 31st, will allow a person to appeal to the clerk of the tax court when an aggrieved person is concerned about an assessment on omitted property. Under current law, he can apply to either the tax assessor or the Department of Revenue. As the representative of the Department of Revenue indicated during the public hearing on the 31st, the intent of the bill is to just eliminate the duplicate notices of appeal.
All right. Is there any discussion of this bill? This is the bill that just gets rid of the second notice. Any discussion of this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move that House Bill 2234 be reported to the House floor with a due pass recommendation from the House Revenue Committee.
Thank you. Is there a subsequent referral on this bill?
No.
No subsequent referral. Representative Butler has moved the bill to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Both aye. Rosenbaum is excused. The bill, having met the required majority, is declared passed and will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This may be a bill for the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2234 be placed on the consent calendar of the House of Representatives.
Is there any objection? Without objection, it is so ordered. And we close the public hearing, or excuse me, the work session on House Bill 2234. The chair is going to have to leave for another meeting. I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Vice Chair Reed for the additional public hearings today.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2155. And who do we have? We'll first have a summary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. The 2155, as we discussed on the 30th, well, this is the first time it's been up. It actually increases the maximum amortization rate from 30 to 40 years for home loans that are made to veterans under Article 11A of the Oregon Constitution. Under current law, there's a 30-year period of amortization, and that's just basically all.
Thank you. There's some testimony.
Okay. First on the list is Val Conley. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Val Conley. I'm Administrator of Veterans Services Division for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The purpose of this legislation is to make an additional home loan product available to borrowers to assist them in becoming homeowners through the Oregon Veterans Home Loan Program. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has been making loans to qualified veterans since 1945, when the Oregon legislature created the department for the purpose of offering home loans for World War veterans to assist these returning vets with obtaining veterans benefits to which they were entitled as a result of their service to a grateful state and nation. Since 1945, the department has made more than 333,000 home loans with a positive economic impact to the state of more than $7.4 billion. Through the years, the legislature has helped bring necessary changes to the program. If passed, this legislation would amend ORS 407.275 to give the director the flexibility of being able to offer an additional loan product to eligible qualified veterans. It would provide an increased number of Oregon veterans in the already existing pool with the opportunity to attain home ownership with a low interest rate state home loan. The pool of eligible veterans would not be enlarged. It would allow lower monthly mortgage payments for borrowers. Some veteran home loan applicants have demonstrated the ability for repayment but lack the ability to make the larger payment that a 30-year mortgage requires as compared to a 40-year mortgage. It would provide borrowers with an additional state home loan product option from which to choose. It would also make an additional loan product available to mortgage lenders and brokers who originate state home loans to offer to their clients. The department partners with an expanding statewide network of mortgage lenders and brokers who originate Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home loans. This provides veterans with the convenience of being served in their local communities as the department's loan staff is located in Salem. The department appreciates these important business partners. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs requires mortgage default insurance on any loans in excess of 80% loan-to-value ratios. This insurance protects the agency in the event of default of loans. In addition to requiring mortgage insurance, the department's underwriting guidelines are more stringent than they have been in years past. The department's home loan policies are in line with Fannie Mae guidelines. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I will try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Bruin.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Val, for doing this. I guess my question would be with the, you say the eligible pool hasn't changed, but those that would be able to qualify within that pool change. Can you give me an idea of the numbers we're talking about now, i.e. how many veterans are being turned away because they can't manage the cash flow, the debt service on a 30-year loan, but could on a 40-year loan? And then a follow-up to that is, what era are these veterans? Are they across the board, or are they mostly the younger people coming back from Iraq?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I think this would help a small, younger veteran population in that it would make some who would qualify in every other way except for that payment. They would qualify if they had just a little bit smaller payment. I don't know that we've turned any away because of that, a large number. Could I ask my loan manager to come up here and answer that for me? Thank you.
Please. Now, if you could please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, could you please repeat the question?
Well, the question was basically twofold. First of all, how many people are being turned away that would qualify for debt service under a 40-year amortization, but are but are too tight for a 30-year amortization. And the second question was just sort of demographically, who are these veterans? Are they new? Bella said they're basically younger, newer veterans as opposed to Vietnam or Korea or a veteran.
Steve, can you identify yourself?
Again, my name is Steve Schlag, and I am the loan program manager for the Army Department of Veteran Affairs. To address this, is at this point in time, there we have not experienced anyone that's been turned away in that aspect from a 30-year to a 40-year, since we don't offer 40-year at this point in time. The other part of the demographic issue would be, since we are in a 30-year time frame from eligibility for a veteran to apply for a Oregon veterans loan, we are seeing at this point a wide spectrum of ages, from early 20s into 50s and that kind of situation. So the experience there, insofar as credit has been denied, is extremely limited.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Val and Steve, I hope this doesn't sound impertinent, but I just need to know, where were you in 1980 through 82? Were you working with the vets? I need to know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Butler, I was working for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, I was a banker in that era.
Okay. Well, Steve, if I could follow up, you folks then had some experience when the department got itself upside down in the early 80s. My concern is that if I run the numbers correctly on a $200,000 home, 30 years versus 40 years, the payment's less than $100 a month difference. My concern is that these folks are going to be making an extra $1,000 plus a month for another 120 months. That's another $120,000 approximately over this extra 30 years, or over the extra 10 years. And I've already seen the department go upside down one time. As a member of the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee, we don't want to go back there again. And this is, of course, predicated upon the fact that we've had a 200% rise in values in homes over the last 3.5 years. Mr. Chair, I'm very concerned about the fact that as Representative Bruin indicates, some might have qualified for 40-year loans that hadn't, you know, that may not qualified for 30-year loans, because the payment is just a few dollars a month difference. But the concern is that when they get 10 years into this amortization right now, a fourth of the way into the amortization, 120 months, that they are only 25% into the whole project as opposed to a third of the way into the project. And my concern is that any kinds of downturns in our economy, particularly when we've had this kind of a buildup in the value of home prices, could leave the veterans upside down. Now during the period of 1970, late 70s to the early 1980s, the Veterans Department was the largest lender for primary lender for homes in the nation. I mean, outside of the Federal Home Loan Bank, this was it, and this was right here in Oregon to the veterans, and we had some. I realize that we've tightened down on them, but I'm very concerned about the ability, Mr. Chair, the bonds that have been sold by the Treasurer of this state for the veterans have been sold on the premise that these are 30-year loans or less. And my concern is that if we, this could be a recipe for disaster, and I just express that concern to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Would you like to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. I believe this is just another tool that we will have. I don't expect that it will be used largely. I think this would probably be used in rare instances, when this is probably the only way we could qualify a veteran who qualifies in every other way, except where he can't quite meet the income criteria.
If I could just follow up on that, Steve, you're a banker, banking background. In visiting with a banker recently, when we were talking about people are coming in and looking for loans and looking for an ability to pay off over a period of time. In your experience, what's the first question that they ask of these two questions? What's the APR rate on it, or how much is my monthly payment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, that is exactly correct. Those are the normal questions.
Okay, which is the first of those questions that they will respond to or that they're concerned about?
In my experience...
And your experience is...
In my experience, it's almost equally as important. It is... I would say if you're going to lean one way or the other, it would normally be the annual percentage rate, which can be what is the rate on my loan, which then does affect the payment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I asked that question on the premise that the fellow from that was the executive of the Bank of Nevada told me that 90% of the people that are asking for loans from his bank, 90%, their first question is, how much is my monthly payment? How much is my monthly payment? They're not even the least bit remotely concerned until they recognize that the payment they can fit to it of what the APR is on that loan. My concern is that when they identify, here's two products, and my monthly payment here is $92 less per month than my payment here, the fact that they might have to pay an extra $120,000 to save this $93 a month may outweigh the fact that they have to pay that. In other words, they're looking at first the monthly payment that they can fit themselves into. I'm very concerned about this approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Further questions? If not, we will excuse you. Thank you for your testimony. We also have Mr. McDonald signed up.
For the record, my name is Matt McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon, which includes every federally chartered veterans organization in the state and some that are not federally chartered. We looked at this bill and we were a little concerned initially, but the 40-year mortgage is out there, whether we like it or not. And if a veteran, the younger veteran who tries to get a home, looks at what it's going to cost him, what he can afford, am I eligible for this loan? And what this does is just allows another tool for the Department of Veterans Affairs to make loans. Yes, it may cost more in the long run, but today the young veteran cannot afford that extra amount of money. Therefore, this is just another tool the Department of Veterans Affairs would have. And if he can't qualify there, he's going out and get a 40-year loan from a bank that may cost him a little more initially. So what this is just a tool that allows the Department of Veterans Affairs to loan, hopefully at a lesser APR, to the veteran so he can own a home, or he can own a home that costs a little more that he'd like to have. He would become eligible for this loan at that time, and we do support the bill. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Any questions? Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like staff to be able to tell us how many home loans defaulted in the last significant downturn in the 1980 through 83, 85 period of veterans' loans, and what the fiscal cost of that was in the state of Oregon. I am really, really not concerned about Wall Street banking companies that want to come out and loan 50 years or even loan interest-only loans to Oregonians. I'm really not concerned about those folks. I'm concerned about this approach because it uses the general obligation, the good faith and credit of the state of Oregon behind it, and that credit was severely wounded the last time the market took a real nosedive and we were sitting on a lot of outstanding paper in veterans' loans. So, and I appreciate what Mac's saying, is that they may qualify for another loan that would cost them something less than the 30-year loan, but perhaps even a little more than the 40-year paper if they go to a traditional mortgage company, but it does not place the good faith and credit of the state of Oregon at risk.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any questions for Representative Berger?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. McDonald, has your organization made any inquiries specific to Representative Butler's question about exactly how many loans this might entail and who they're targeted? Do you have any specific information to that or anything that you as an organization have sort of delved into? Is this designed, I guess I'm trying to get at, how deeply you've looked at the needs of the young vets and whether this is designed for them or your constituency that's of your age, young as you are, or mine, young as I am. You get the question.
Well, we have in the organizations, basically 21 organizations are full-time members, then we have some auxiliary members. And we had a couple of young veterans get up and talk about it, and talk about the eligibility, and they'd much rather go to the Department of Veterans Affairs than go out in the economy to get a 40-year loan. And they said, because the Department of Veterans Affairs is normally at a lower APR than the outside, that this is the way they'd like to go. They're going to go out and get the best deal they can, and this is just another way to serve veterans better. True, we had a downturn, and we had problems. Well, we've had them before, and we may have them again. But this is another tool for veterans, or another opportunity for veterans to own a home, and own a home at what we hope is a lesser amount of money than what they'd have to do if they went on the outside to get a home loan. And I can only speak for the two people who did get up when we discussed this at a regular meeting about owning a home and what their thoughts were on it, whether they've done any background information or looked into it more than that, I have no idea.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, with that, well, thank you, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2155 and open public hearing on House Bill 2237. And if we could have a summary on that, please.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2237 will basically eliminate a annual filing requirement for a veteran's exemption. Currently, that exemption is $15,000 on the assessed value of homestead personal property. But you have to file annually. And with this change, you wouldn't have to file annually if three conditions are satisfied. First, the war veteran must have granted the homestead exemption in the previous year. Second, the war veteran claiming the exemption must satisfy the requirements for having disabilities of 40% or more, or a surviving spouse must continue to meet the qualifications for the exemption. And third, the ownership use of the homestead personal property and all other qualifying conditions of that property must remain unchanged. There's also a cleanup in the sense that Section 5 of the bill will allow the maximum exemption to conform to the $15,000, and under current law, 307.370 continues to have the previous exemption amount at $11,670.
Thank you. First up is John Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The department brought this bill in cooperation with county assessors. The assessors received these applications, and we've discussed for years about maybe what to do with this. This particular program is for disabled veterans or their surviving spouses. And in the law, there's five categories of those persons. There's service versus non-service connected disability. There's Department of Veterans Affairs certified versus licensed physician certified. So, and then there's the two surviving spouse categories. One of those categories has a means test. In other words, there's an annual income eligibility requirement. This bill conceptually was to eliminate the annual filing. So long as you're qualified and participated, it would eliminate the annual filing requirement for those persons except for the means tested ones. And there are about a very, very small portion of them. We think that annual filing makes the most sense administratively when the circumstances are not subject to change. So if there's no income test and all they have to do is be disabled, which is one of those conditions that's less likely to go away, there's no age issues, and they've already served. So for the vast majority of these people, we cannot see a real benefit in having an annual application. That's the concept. I was reading the bill last night, however, and found a mistake. I apologize. I don't know how many times I've read this bill. But because there are those five situations, two of them were left out in the draft. We missed it. Other people missed it, and I apologize for that. So I'm asking the chair for the authority to get an amendment to add those two additional folks in, and they have to do with those that are service-connected disabled. So that's the concept for the bill, that's the program, and that's the reason why we think annual filing doesn't make sense for these particular people, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, where exactly you've got, are we under Section 1, B, A, B, and C, and there's a D and E, is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, as Mary pointed out, the exemption from the annual filing, the elimination of the need, it starts in line 19, page 1.
Okay.
The claim need not be filed if, and then it lists the three conditions, A, B, and C. The first one deals with the homestead. The last one, C, deals with that nothing's changed in terms of ownership. B is where it occurs. And in B, in line 23, it says, the individual claiming the exemption is a war veteran described in 307-251A.
Okay.
1A is Department of Veterans Affairs certified 40% disabled.
Okay.
But it's not service-connected, just disabled.
Okay.
Now, the reason why there's a distinction is because there's a $15,000 benefit for non-service-connected and an $18,000 benefit for the service-connected. So that's why they're parsing all this. So 1A is that DVA-certified non-service-connected. Then it goes on in line 24 to say, or the surviving spouse of that person who is in 1C.
Mm-hmm.
So we would add to line 23 the words and subsection 2A, which in 307-250 references the service-connected disabled person.
Okay.
And in line 24 we would add or 2B, which is the service-connected disabled veteran's surviving spouse.
Got it. That's where you're at. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had actually met with staff on this previously relative to 307.250, and my concern was, John, what's happening, and my veterans people brought this to me recently on behalf of a group of veterans in the Treasure Valley, specifically concerned with the fact that some veterans' widows are being taken advantage of by immediately following the death of their veteran spouse are remarrying and then end up the next year single again after they've had some of their assets dissipated, unfortunately. The question that they asked was, and I would like your reaction to this, not necessarily that we have to do something, but their concern was that if the widow of a veteran was unmarried at the time that they would have been requalifying the next year, even though they had been married and divorced during the year, would that be something that could be considered and would be feasible under this arrangement, where they would not have to requalify?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think you could certainly make a decision to add that. I'm just trying to think logistically, administratively, how counties would sort that out. And right now, the limitation is the surviving spouse remaining unmarried. And interestingly enough, the veteran who was means tested The surviving spouse of that veteran is not means tested, so they can qualify regardless. So there is that part, but the benefit does stop as soon as they remarry. There's no provision in the current law that says if they become unremarried or divorced or whatever the circumstances are and then remarry again, there's no provision whatsoever in the law that we can see for that. So you would probably have to provide an amendment that says something about how that would occur, and then counties would have to would not know that unless an application were filed, I assume, and then that would have to be verified somehow.
Mr. Chair, in prior conversations with John in the department, the truth of the matter is that back to the counties, there's very little way of verifying if the widow has remarried, divorced, and is single at the time that the reapplication is occurring. Right now, the reapplication process ferrets those folks out. What my veterans contacts were asking was that if they were remarried and divorced, so that at the time that they would be requalifying, but for the fact that they are now under this piece of legislation automatically requalified, that the department and that the counties have no way of, short of going out and asking each one of them if they are still single and if they had been married and divorced during the year, that technically they could just go ahead and say, hey, I'm still single. I'm still the widow of a qualifying veteran. It's my understanding that remarriage, in effect, disqualifies them presently, and that if they were remarried and divorced during the year, they can still come forward and say, I'm still the widow of a veteran. Right now, there's, again, no mechanism to do this. I'm still the widow of a veteran, and I still qualify. But for the fact that I was married 3 months back here by some scallywag that took advantage of me. And that's what they were concerned was, that there had been at least a couple of the veterans locally in our valley whose, after they had passed away, their wives were almost immediately, within just a few months, remarried, then had lost their inheritance through these shenanigans that were going on. Then they were subsequently divorced, still single at the time it was time for them to come back and qualify. Again, there is no mechanism at present to really ferret that out. And they're asking, could we insert the language that they are single at the time that they would have qualified? Would they still be qualified as a the widow of a veteran? And that would be a policy choice that the committee could make at the same time that Department of Revenue is asking for the other amendment to add the other two qualifying factors for the widow in there.
And Representative Butler, you're suggesting that as it stands now, that's not specifically mentioned, so that in that scenario, it would not be, there's no explanation for that.
It is not specifically mentioned. However, it's my understanding, and it's their understanding, the veterans' understanding of the law, that as soon as that qualifying widow is remarried, whether it's for a day or a week or a month, unless it's actually annulment, so that the remarriage didn't actually take place, then that is a disqualifying event to that widow.
Disqualifying event.
A permanently disqualifying event, yes, sir.
Okay.
And it was, again, it's a policy choice that could be made, but their question is that it actually has happened where the widows come back and have remarried. There's no way of ferreting that out from the county perspective right now. It's my understanding that the department doesn't have a true method of actually ferreting those folks out and winnowing those widows out that may have been taken advantage of during the interim period.
Do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think the language specifically is remaining unmarried. And so I assume if you remarry, then you're not. Remaining is kind of an ing word that it's a continuous process, I think. So I think your analysis is correct. I think that person would not be eligible. Just a concern, question, comment might be that it may also work in the other way, where they remarry and they're not in real financial need. I mean, I don't know. Just to be aware that there's no means test. So you could be a wealthy, remarried, previously widowed person and be getting a property tax exemption.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Butler,
I think you're suggesting that, you know, that somehow the counties keep track of this, people that have been taken advantage of.
No, really not.
Okay.
There is no mechanism presently that for anyone to keep track. It's based upon their remaining unmarried. When I come in for my new application under the old law, before this bill, when I come in for my, are you remaining unmarried? Yes, I am unmarried at this time, as I'm making this application. Did I remain unmarried from my deceased veteran spouse? The answer is no. And there's no way to ferret that out but for the annual application.
Okay. I think the answer here, if there is an answer, is for veterans groups to make it very clear that, to widows, that you remarry, you will lose this benefit under the law, and be proactive in protecting widows and widowers, because we're going to have a lot of those now too. Because I don't know how the counties could administratively figure this out, even with more frequent reporting. Right.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask a question of Representative Butler.
Go ahead.
Without getting us too far afield, Representative Butler, is there a case here of professional asset gleaners? Do we have the same men showing up marrying widows?
I don't know that that's the case, Representative, but that it was immediately of concern to me because the expression that was made by and these folks, unfortunately, they're on both sides of the river, and they couldn't cite me any Oregon cases, but they could cite me two cases in Idaho this past year where the widows were remarried and then divorced in a very short period of time after they lost their death benefits, their husband's death benefits to the gleaner, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's a great word because, you know, these are some pretty unscrupulous people that may be looking down the list and watching the cemeteries for, you know, the full honors ceremonies and then going after these widows. So I think I will certainly accept the pleasure of the committee relative to this issue, and I think it's probably an issue to go back to our veterans organizations and encourage them, because there really truly is no mechanism today. And even under this bill, it puts it to more. This bill lends itself to more abuse than what we presently have available to us today, because they don't have to come back at the end of the second year and say, I was married for 3 weeks or 3 months and now divorced. I am remaining unmarried at the time that I am qualifying anew. And maybe we better make that specific, that the remaining means that the last spouse of record was in fact the qualifying veteran.
We could do that.
That's a good point, Representative Witt. My hope is that this is not something that's statewide or nationwide a concern.
Mr. Chairman, if that possibly is the case, I think it merits looking into. That's a pretty unscrupulous tactic if that's going on. So.
Indeed. Thank you, Representative Witt. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, one other suggestion. The widow who finds him or herself, widow or widower, who finds him or herself having been financially mistreated, could apply for the Senior Deferral Program, which is a program whereby, this program assumes they have a home, so they haven't been swindled out of the home. So they still have a home, and they can't afford their taxes. This is a very relatively a small benefit when you think about it, $15,000, but the Senior Deferral Program would allow them to defer all of their taxes and let the equity in their home someday deal with it. But it's a good program.
Do you have any further questions for Mr. Phillips? Thank you. Excuse you. And invite Mr. McDonald back up if you have some more comments on this bill.
For the record, my name is Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. When we discussed this bill, we saw it as a win-win proposition. It's a win proposition for the counties because they no longer have to spend the administrative time or spend the cost of mailing these out to the various disabled veterans or their widows, which are a win for the veteran because he no longer has to spend the time redoing what the county already knows, and doesn't have to spend the 39 cents for sending the mail out. Representative Butler brought up a very interesting thing, and I'm speaking for myself, not for the United Veterans of Oregon on this, because we didn't discuss it. But if the veteran dies, the county's going to know about it, and the widow would have to then apply, the way I understand it, for this benefit, because she'd be a new beneficiary. And if the committee would like to include the widow if she remarries and the husband dies or is divorced, that's up to the committee. But we do support the non-reporting. I've lived in my home for 15 years now. Nothing, status hasn't changed. If I die tomorrow and my wife picks it up, she would have to my way of understanding, she would have to reapply for it. So she has to go to the county to reapply. So I don't see really any problem with the bill itself. But it's up to you whether you want to change if the widow remarries and the husband and the second husband, third husband, whatever it is, or opposite the widower dies, whether they'd be eligible again or not. But this is basically for disabled veterans, which is not the 365,000 veterans, but about 65,000 veterans at the most in the state of Oregon. And I just see it as a win-win for counties, win-win for the veteran. And I think if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. You've done a good job. Thank you. It appears that there might be some issues remaining to be worked on for this bill, and we don't have it scheduled for a work session in any case. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2237. And we have completed our agenda, so unless there's anything to do with the order, we are adjourned. Thank you.